Welcome to the Curious Women Podcast. I'm your host, Kylie Fignano, and I'm here with my co-host, Meg Hager. Here, we're going to have chats about women's health to teach you the things that you didn't know you didn't know.
So, Kylie, what are you drinking over there? The most important question of the
I know. I was so excited for this today because I have a lot. I've got two. I have two. Look at this.
Only
which
two
is like all? Not I was just going to say that's not uncommon. I don't know why I felt like that was exciting. But and I think I've talked about both of these before, but they do happen to be my favorite right now. I've got my Athletic Greens over I do actually really love. And but I added to this, I put my vitamin D drops in here. I've do you like a liposomal? Yeah, so I just pop those in here. And I put some pomegranate aloe. I know. How noxious does that sound?
You've
so
mentioned
gross
this
me.
Aloe before, though.
It's
and
so
it's
good.
Super
I know.
Delicious.
It's so tasty. It's so tasty. So that's what I have over here. And then this is an iced coffee with Four Sigmatic. They've got those little instant coffee packs that I just put in. It's just the best. This is the adaptogen blend. And sometimes I put a little something in it, but this is just black. It's very, very delicious without anything else in it.
Huh. Nice. You got a fancy little glass today, too, for your coffee.
I'm hiding the part that it says, I drink and I know things. Like, this is obviously not my glass. Okay, this is real. I drink and I know things. I do not. What? No. I mean, I do know things, but I don't know them when I drink. That's for sure. What are you drinking? What I know what Ashley's got. Ashley's got a matcha, don't you?
I do. It's an iced soy latte, soy matcha latte.
Ooh.
Yeah. Iced soy matcha latte. Did you make this at home?
I did, yeah. It's kind of like my daily drink.
Can you tell us? Because that sounds delicious. So ice, soy milk.
Yeah, so I do it like the traditional way. Like I sift it through, then I whisk it, then I add a little water. And I put some Got Love in there.
Yes. You sure did. Yes, you sure did.
Perfect. Yeah, and then I did, then I add a little bit of soy to that, and then I put it over ice.
That sounds
yum.
Delicious. I'm too lazy to go do all that, but I definitely think when we're done recording, I'm going to go get me an iced soy matcha latte, for sure.
That sounds delish. I have, Four Sigmatic has, actually, I sent it to you when I made it, actually. They have instant matcha.
No, did not know that.
Wait, don't they? Yes, I think I sent this to you. Yeah, I have it. I know. Why am I questioning? Yes. I will try it in a soy latte form. I'll let you all know.
Bring it to the next step.
I'll bring it to
recording.
The next step. Exactly. Exactly.
Let it know how it, let you know how it's going. I am being boring today. I just have my decaf coffee, and then my usual ginseng tea with the Ovacetol to get myself going.
That is your drink.
That's
your drink.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, we always catch Meg when it's in the morning for her because she's six hours behind me. I could, like, do – this is not the first coffee of the day. There's, like, all – who God only knows what we're hitting over here at this time of the day. It's 5:30 here. It's still early for you.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't be one of the. I always joke that it's like happy hour when Kylie's time, and but yet I'm gonna be the one to show up to one of these podcast recordings with a mimosa for sure.
Right. We should just plan that.
Let's
oh God, that would be real interesting.
You know what? We were planning a very heavy kind of episode for our upcoming episodes. Maybe we'll just lighten it up by bringing we'll drink some mimosas while we discuss.
This is you know, we got some mix up with Ashley on the time zones because we're working with three different time zones on this call as usual. And so Meg and I just chatted and planned for an hour, and I think that was the most productive piece that came out of it right there.
I think so too. Yeah.
We welcome you to join us. Unless you're driving while you're listening to this, then, you know, be a responsible human.
Yeah, maybe not. All right. Well, I'm excited to dive in, guys. What about you?
Yeah, let's do it. All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Curious Women. Today, we have one of my dear friends and lately extremely fortunate to call her a mentor, Ashley. She is also a dietitian. Ashley, why don't you go ahead and tell us who you are, what you do, and what your specialty is?
Thank you, Kylie, and good to meet you, Meg, too. And I've just started listening to your podcast. I'm so excited to see how it evolves. It's I love the title too.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it is. It's definitely very appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely how I describe you, Kylie. That's
Thank you.
Yeah, so my name is Ashley Hurst. So I am the owner of Crohn's and Colitis Dietitians and also Got Love Supplements. And I started this journey. I've had gut symptoms all of my life, as early as I can remember. Thought it was totally normal. Thought it was normal to touch your stomach and feel pain. I just thought everybody did. So lived with that for years. And it wasn't until college that I started to wonder if it was all okay. I saw blood in my stool. I was actually in a medical nutrition therapy class and reading the textbook about Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And I thought, you know, well, gosh, this is, you know, I know everybody does that in dietetics and med school and whatever. You read the textbooks and you think you have it.
Yes.
but this time I was really like, okay, maybe I'm not crazy. And, you know, I had gone to several doctors and was dismissed, like a lot of people, especially women are. You know, they basically told me that, you know, I was an athlete at the time in college. I was pretty healthy, and they basically said, you look too healthy to have it, which totally shifted, you know, later on, just thinking through, like, it really resonates with how much Crohn's and ulcerative colitis is an invisible disease. It's something that we don't see on the outside. And the term health doesn't really adequately describe, you know, it's such a vague term that can mean so many different things. But anyways, so for about 2 years, I was kind of dismissed and finally found somebody who took me seriously and did a colonoscopy and then was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. And then kind of began that first year, which was very confusing and scary. And, you know, I wasn't sure what the rest of my life would look like at that point. Because you start reading things online when you get a scary diagnosis like that. And so I was up against a lot. Being in college, I didn't have a lot of resources. I was working 3 jobs at the time. Still didn't have health insurance. And this was back in 2011, where you could get rejected from health insurance for having a pre-existing condition.
Wow.
I didn't have health care. So then medication would be anywhere from $700 to $1,200 a month, which was impossible, you know, for me at the time. So for me, I kind of fell into nutrition because I didn't have the resources to pay for meds, you know, not because I thought nutrition was the only route for people. But, you know, it forced me to really lean on a lot of nutrition knowledge and find that out for myself and look for people that had expertise in the area, which there weren't many at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I really uncovered, it really got me through a lot. Learning nutrition for IBD really helped me and saved my life at times. And so I kind of fell in love with learning about the gut microbiome and started a private practice. And I saw kind of all kinds of things in the beginning, but I always got really excited when I would get someone with Crohn's and colitis, and that always was really fun. And, you know, but honestly, I hid that part of me for years. I didn't tell anybody that I had IBD because I just didn't want it to become my life, ironically. I didn't want to Yeah, I didn't want it to define me, which now it totally defines me, and I'm glad that I did. But I think it was around 2012, my cousin was diagnosed with Crohn's, and he was my first friend, you know, with IBD. And he opened me up to the idea. He had a completely different take on it. He used his disease as a way to connect to others, and it brought him a lot of hope and joy. And so I saw that, and I was just like, wow, okay, that's not what I had in mind. But, you know, I started to open up more about what I had, and he passed away in 2018. And in that process, I saw how underserved the community is, and through my own experiences with just kind of being dismissed and, you know, being told nutrition doesn't matter at all. And and I think because of that, but seeing how underserved the community was and really starting to value the connection that it brought me, I think that's what really motivated me to specialize in the area and to start the process of, you know, giving IBD community more tools, you know, to, beyond just medication. Wow. To help enhance the rate of remission and enhance their ability to recover and ability to have a better quality of life.
Yeah. What a journey. Oh my gosh.
Wow. I didn't know that about your cousin, Ashley.
Yeah.
That adds a layer of things that just adds a layer.
Yeah. But also, yeah. I think it really is powerful that it seems like your cousin was the one to really change your outlook on having a condition like IBD, and it seemed like it was a really positive one, and that's really cool, because that'll be with you forever, you know? And a lot of our listeners who are struggling with IBD or even with another condition that is considered more of a silent disease, that's a really, really empowering way to look at it. And so I hope that that's like our first little takeaway nugget.
I love that you said that, Meg, because I was going to add, I mean, Ashley, when you just leaned in and decided this is me, look at what, I mean, if that's not a message for people, well, I guess that'll become clearer as we continue to move forward and you can share with us what you do, and we'll give you all these resources at the end as well. But I am wondering, can you tell everybody what is IBD? What is Crohn's? What is colitis? Is there an umbrella term? How are all of these things related but different? Because we've thrown a bunch of these terms out, and I want people to understand what we're talking about. Because a lot of the symptoms that I think you're going to go through, people are going to say, oh my God, that's me. Do I have this thing? And it might be helpful, just like you had your experience, to be able to say, okay, here are the things that are going to want you to make you want to start really thinking about it. And here is another thing it might be that's different. So go ahead and just see. I mean, we've got IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis. What is all of this?
Yeah, so IBD is inflammatory bowel disease, whereas IBS is irritable bowel syndrome. And the main difference between the two is chronic inflammation. So with inflammatory bowel disease, you're going to see a much higher level of inflammation longer term. So you're going to see that in lab work. You're going to see that visibly in colonoscopy.
Okay.
Yeah. And IBD, so inflammatory bowel disease, includes a variety of different diagnoses, depending on the location of the inflammation. So the most common inflammatory bowel diseases are Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And there's also microscopic colitis, which is a little more rare. Now, some people get confused too with ulcerative colitis versus colitis, because you can have colitis related to infection that's temporary, but it's not the same thing as an inflammatory bowel disease that's chronic, so for the long haul.
Okay, so the real key here is the chronic inflammation. So this is something that just like, really? Well, let me ask the question. Does it go away, or is it something that's just managed?
So if we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease and not like a acute or short-term colitis, if we're talking about inflammatory bowel disease, it is long-term. It's chronic. Meaning it's an autoimmune disease too. So it involves your immune system. Now, you can have periods of remission which is ideal, you know, and that can look almost, it can look and feel almost like it's gone forever, which there's all these different types of what we call remission or periods where you're not having an active disease. And this is where a lot of people, I think, get confused. Not a lot of people with IBD actually know about the four types of remission. And it can actually make a huge difference in terms of, you know, having less fear around the disease and knowing what you're going for and what the treatment plan is going to look like moving forward.
How does someone get diagnosed with IBD? Because I know a lot of people.
Good question.
Will either self-diagnose or very unhelpfully be told that they have IBS, which is something that is much different, we're saying, right? This is different. It's not the same as IBD. So what is the kind of diagnosing criteria that somebody can maybe even start to seek out if they're really starting to think that this is something, an avenue in which they could start to get some help?
Yeah, so the diagnosis is really through colonoscopy and biopsy of the GI tract. So you have to do a colonoscopy to get a diagnosis, and then they'll typically do blood work to confirm, you know, how severe it is, what stage of disease, and the colonoscopy also tells you where the disease is located. Because with ulcerative colitis, it's very commonly on the left side of the colon, into the rectum area, whereas
is there a reason for that?
Not necessarily. It's just very common. Whereas Crohn's extends throughout the digestive tract and small intestine, and tends to be more patchy. Whereas ulcerative colitis kind of starts at the rectum typically.
I did not know that it was more common.
You know,
left side.
I know this is a little off topic, but it's also really common. A lot of my clients typically have worse acne on the left side for some reason. I don't know if there's a thing. Maybe it's like the left side of the body.
So do I.
More prone to. Okay. Oh, yeah? You're one of them?
It's very interesting. So I have had, just in my personal journey with it, everything that goes wrong is on my left side. I've literally been in the hospital with an infection on my left side of my left leg. I've had like chronic ankle injuries on my left ankle. It's just really unusual, and it makes you wonder if there's some sort of connection, you know. I mean, it does seem
so bizarre.
Yeah, I mean the digestive tract connects to so much, you know.
Right.
It wouldn't be surprising if they uncover that one day.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll have to do a little research. Maybe we'll come back to you with an episode on why your left side is more susceptible to inflammation.
Stay tuned.
Unsolved Mysteries, part 4,000.
Of the female body.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's what we should have named our podcast. Unsolved Mysteries of the Female Body.
We'd have endless episodes.
We really would.
Ashley, I think that I know what you're going to say, but I think I'm personally dying to ask, and I know it's one of the really common questions that in general people have, and I am intentionally going to oversimplify this question, making it nearly impossible for you to answer, but I'll do it anyway. This is a common question because it's one of the things that is the most painful, or can be the most painful, is eating. So generally speaking, people who are, maybe they're newly diagnosed, maybe they've known about it and are just kind of struggling, what do you tell them in terms of what they should or should not consider adding or keeping out of their diet? How do you love hate that question? It's the worst question.
We started
for a
out
dietitian
with the worst
to ask
one.
A dietitian.
Like, instead of doing your job over 6 months, just do it in 2 minutes and solve it for me.
Yeah.
Right.
Basically. Yep, exactly.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I warned you. I knew I was doing it. That somehow that makes it different.
I'm sorry, Ashley, that Kylie didn't forewarn you that we really brought you on this show to torture you with words. Anyway, proceed.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, and I know I didn't clearly explain this when I first mentioned it, but I usually start off by explaining to people the four types of remission, and because that's an important shift, mindset shift, to really understand food and what to eat and how it all matters. So there's four types. So there is clinical remission, which it means you don't have symptoms. So symptoms would be something like bloating, diarrhea, constipation, abdominal pain. And then the next level is called biochemical remission. That's where your blood work doesn't show any inflammation, or stool testing doesn't show any inflammation. Okay. And then that next deeper remission is called endoscopic remission, and then also histological remission. And with those, you're doing a colonoscopy the colonoscopy is showing no signs of inflammation in the colon. They're also seeing, with histological, you're seeing an actual healing to the digestive tract itself. So you actually don't see any signs of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis.
Ooh, we love that.
Yeah, on the surface sounds like, well, is that a cure? It's not necessarily a cure. It just means that you've had healing to the digestive tract lining and you're more likely to stay in remission long term. So with Crohn's, it affects the both top and bottom layer of the digestive lining, whereas ulcerative colitis is just more on the surface. So when you see healing to that, it's a good sign that treatment is working, and you want to stay in that place so that you don't develop flares later. Mm-hmm. Now, where a lot of people get confused with when it comes to eating in IBD is that what happens is you try to navigate what to eat, you know, based on how you're feeling and how that food how responsive you are to that food. And so when you have IBD and you're in a flare, everything feels really bad, you know? So yeah. You start taking away foods one by one, and then you end up with maybe 3 to 5 safe foods that you can eat without triggering symptoms, which is kind of a dangerous place to be. On the surface, it seems like that's the right thing to do, but it's actually not, because it puts you at risk for less diversity in the gut, mm-hmm. Harm to your microbiome, more at risk for malnutrition, more at risk for nutrient deficiencies, less ability to recover and actually get to remission. Mm-hmm. So that is the common approach when it comes to figuring out what to eat for IBD, although not the approach that I would recommend. Mm-hmm. What we teach people to do is recognize that there's a difference between irritation and inflammation. So Ooh. Even when...
Can you tell us more about that distinction?
Yeah, that was really nice.
So about half of people with Crohn's and ulcerative colitis have IBS as well. And I would say that number is well below the real number. I think, you know, because I do see, I just see that number being much higher in actual practice. But irritation is where you have symptoms. So bloating, constipation, diarrhea. Inflammation is less noticeable with symptoms. We're not always going to notice inflammation. So whereas you might have fast food or something and not have any symptoms from it, that doesn't mean it isn't causing harm. It can be adding to inflammation as a pattern in the diet. And the same thing goes for, let's say you have spinach or blueberries, and it causes more diarrhea or urgency. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the food that caused it or that it's causing harm. It can be causing irritation symptoms, but not inflammation. It could be actually helping you in terms of dialing back inflammation. Mm-hmm. So understanding the two differences, I think, is key in moving past just that, looking at your diet with a microscope and trying to piece apart what's what. It's better to take a step back and look at the bigger picture of, like, what are the key components that we need in a diet to see good results, and how can we modify that to make it more tolerable to where you're not miserable with symptoms. So that's kind of where we help people, is figuring out modifications to make so that you have less irritation symptoms.
That's such a good distinction, and I think I just want to highlight what you said, because I think that even for those who are not struggling with IBD or who are struggling with any, I think this could apply to pretty much the whole spectrum of conditions in general. Like I'm thinking of my acne clients, right? Like there's triggers and there's actual root causes. And what you're saying is there's irritation and inflammation are different. And so there are certain things that may make you uncomfortable that might cause symptoms, but might not necessarily be causing inflammation that you can't feel, and vice versa. And that's a really good point. I think that's a good takeaway, kind of just across the board. No, you could probably apply that to any health condition, really.
Yeah. And I.
Ashley, when you, sorry, when you explain that to people, do you find mentally, emotionally, that they can just sort of take a little bit of a breath? Because I imagine that if you're dealing with symptoms that you physically have to actually manage every day, it can very often start to feel like no matter what you do, you're failing or making yourself worse. And actually, I think that you're going to get to this, but if you want to touch on a little bit of how this whole thing does impact somebody's mental health and their relationship with their food, I'd love to dig into that somehow. Because when you're telling me that people will intentionally end up eating 3 to 5 foods, that's just not a good place mentally to be. You can't feel good about yourself. You can't feel good about your relationship to food. You don't have a choice. You have to eat. And when that only thing you have to do every day causes you to feel like you're writhing in pain. Yeah, just speak to some of that if you will, because and you tell me, I imagine it's an underspoken component to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, and not just narrow down to just the safe foods. I mean, we see that in almost every person who starts working with us is that they only have a few foods they can eat, or they're just avoiding eating altogether so that they're not miserable.
Yeah,
Which
that's tough.
I do see that too. And it's really no surprise to me that, you know, 1 in 4 IBD patients has an eating disorder and 80% have disordered eating.
One
Say
in
that again,
four?
Ashley. Say that
Whoa.
again.
So 1 in 4, so 1 in 4 IBD patients have an eating disorder, like an actual eating disorder, and up to 80% have disordered eating. And it's a unique area when you combine the IBD with eating disorder because it doesn't involve doesn't typically involve body image or anything like that. It's just more a reality. It's like
Right.
food is painful. There's nothing there's nothing you can do to change it. It hurts when you're in a flare and it's not being controlled really well. It's very hard. It's kind of the natural thing to do is to kind of want to restrict more.
Yeah, I imagine it's a lot of fear involved in that too. Like something that's so normal and not only necessary for life, like food, is actually a huge source of fear and stress. And that's got to be very, very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think, and it's a component that even is hard to address because, you know, if you send someone to, you know, a eating disorder dietitian or a place that specializes in that, adding in that Crohn's and ulcerative colitis component is
It's too
it's
much.
just it's a very specialized area, and you kind of need a little bit of both to fully be able to help somebody.
Nobody wants to listen to you tell them it's okay when you're not okay. Like, let me show you how not okay I am by eating this blueberry here. You'll see. Right? Yeah, that would be a challenging, that'd be challenging. So okay. My next question, the next thing that's coming up for me is the autoimmune component, because I think that that's a really big factor that differentiates IBD from other types of IBS or GI conditions in general. We'll just keep it very vague. So what can people be thinking about? And sometimes maybe the answer is like, we don't always know. I'm curious. What are some of the triggers that will help, that will put people into flares that they can either be mindful of, learn more about, or be on the lookout for themselves to decide if that happens to be one for them? Because let's just say they get into one of these different stages of remission.
Yeah.
What do they need to be doing to keep themselves there or on the lookout for without being overly hypervigilant and causing more stress, which I imagine is probably one of the triggers because it's a trigger for everything.
Yeah. So I'd say with regards to food choices, it's not eating that one food. It's a food pattern that makes the big difference in the long run. So they have studied, you know, food patterns in IBD and what people have more of in the diet that are more likely to be in remission and what people have more of that are more likely to be in a flare. And it makes sense to me, even just from an understanding of the microbiome and what our microbiome prefers. But you know, ironically, the one food that people restrict the most is fiber when you have IBD. But that is one of the key components that is important for healing. So fiber helps our bodies create something called butyrate, which reduces inflammation. And they have studied in Crohn's specifically that when they looked at people in the long term, the people who did not restrict fiber were 40% less likely to be in a flare.
That's a big percent. Holy moly.
Not restricting yes. fiber.
Not restricting. So that's
the I want opposite. You all to hear that.
That's the opposite of what people think. That's also the opposite of what we're still telling people. We still tell people with IBD all the time to go on low residue or, you know, start restricting. It's not what
I was
what
just going to say
says.
That. I have a very interesting, I just want to pop in here because this blows my mind because I remember being in school to be a dietitian and that's exactly what they said. And I also remember questioning doctors when I was working in the hospital who were being hospitalized. I know, whoop, tap. I'm always the one who did it. I got in numerous fights.
I love you for this.
I may or may not have cried afterwards, but I did.
They don't need to know that part.
They don't need to know that part, no. But yeah, like it's such, it just blows my mind that this is what we're still being told, or people who have this condition are still being told, but it just seems like it's so far behind what the research is saying.
Yeah. Well, I remember just a few years ago when I was in clinical, there's a worksheet, low residue. I had a folder of them. And you handed it out to every single person who came in with this diagnosis. To all of my patients who I gave incorrect information to, I apologize. It wasn't my choice. It was, I'm not going to say any official terms, but, you know, these were not unofficial worksheets. They were provided by, you know, the organizations at B, you know? And I think, Ashley, just to get back to your point, it really is a testament to why so many people without the proper guidance and education, because why would they have that? That doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't, right? They're going to listen to what they've been told over and over and over again, right? So I think if you guys, if nothing else, whether you have IBD or not, fiber is the way.
Yep. Fiber is the thing.
Way, right? Yeah. I mean, 40% is no joke. That's no accident. That's no...
No. So, you know. I think you were probably getting to this, Ashley, before I interrupted you, but tell us why. Why is fiber so important to the healing component?
Yeah, fiber is the main fuel source for a lot of our helpful gut bacteria, like lactobacillus, bifidobacteria, acromantia. They consume that bacteria and they reward us with something after the fact. So they reward us with something called short-chain fatty acids. The one I spoke about was butyrate, which helps to reduce inflammation. It also helps with healing up the digestive tract lining, supporting a healthy immune response. There's a number of different things, even changing the pH in the colon and making it more more stable, making everything more stable. So there's a lot of really important things that occur with fiber. And without it, what we see is that gut bacteria tend to die off a bit, sometimes permanently. So when we restrict and restrict and for long periods of time, It's causing damage. It's, and you know, our gut bacteria, our gut in itself is kind of like a plant. We need to water it. If you don't water the plant, it can die.
I love that analogy.
Yeah. Oh
that's so cute.
Yeah. So, so fiber is important from that perspective. And, you know, in terms of what we know about IBD is we know that plants in the diet is important, diversity, which is not surprising from what we know about gut health in general. Things that tend to flare up. I think the one that's most surprising to me is coconut oil. Coconut oil and dairy fats were found to be, because of the myric acid content, were found to be big triggers for flares in IBD patients.
Coconut oil.
Yeah. Myric acid is a saturated fat, yeah or no?
Yeah.
I guess it has to be. So I'm just curious for those who are listening to know what that is.
So in 2020, they did a bunch of scientists and IBD specialists got together and kind of identified some of the problematic foods for IBD. And that those were two that were two of about 10 different things. Now, from what I understand from gut bacteria, because that's an interest of mine, there is a gut bacteria called Biophila wadsworthia that is basically means bile loving. So Biophila stands for bile loving. And it likes to consume bile. So things that trigger more bile, like high saturated fats, it will grow in population and cause a little bit of harm to the digestive tract. So that's my thought around why that is, why is particularly in IBD more so than maybe other conditions. Because with IBD, we already have gut microbiome changes and things going on in the immune system that leave us a little bit more vulnerable. So those things are more of a trigger than for a healthy person or someone who's dealing with IBS or something like that.
Can you just briefly kind of touch on what those things are you were mentioning? Says, I know we've just to kind of like tie it up, but the autoimmune piece and the things that just make people with IBD more susceptible to these changes in the microbiome.
I would say, one, we have chronic inflammation going on, especially if you're in a flare. So anytime you have that, you have potential damage being caused to digestive tract. You can have physical changes occur in the digestive tract. Just the inflammation component alone, driving down nutrients and causing nutrient deficiencies, which changes our response to all kinds of things. The other component is the gut barrier tends to be a little bit leakier or more permeable. In IBD, that's one of the key features of it that they think, why they think some of the things happens the way it does. And I think a lot of the combination of things, including just we have a different microbiome than a healthy person, you tend to see certain, there is a database somewhere, I'll have to look for the name of it, where you can actually look up different conditions and see kind of what we know about what tends to be high, what tends to be low in that particular disease.
Meaning like for the microbiome or just in general, like blood work and all that kind of stuff?
In the microbiome, yeah.
Wow, cool.
That's
I would love
super
that.
Interesting.
Yeah. I would love to see that.
I'll look it up for you. I can't remember the name. But yeah, there's a lot of key differences. And I think it can make it a lot more difficult for someone with IBD, you know, if we're we just need a lot more extra special care, I guess.
Yeah.
Need a little bit more microbiome support.
yeah. And I imagine it's really a long-term sort of like you need to get on board with doing this long-term because it's not the sort of thing where if you address the root cause, it's just going to stay away necessarily because of the autoimmune component. Would that be correct to say?
Yeah.
And is there any research? Do we happen to know what causes this particular autoimmune disease? I mean, I know autoimmunity tends to be the sort of elusive thing for most autoimmune diseases. Is there any research that we know of that kind of points a finger in a general direction?
I mean, I think there's maybe, I could point to maybe five to 10 risk factors, but not necessarily one. Risk factors being antibiotic exposure, and that makes sense because you're killing everything off and it just creates a higher tendency towards pathogens, which can trigger the immune system and cause kind of something more chronic. Vitamin D deficiency. So that's a big one, and particularly with people living in locations where they're not getting a lot of sun, or Canada in particular, we see a lot of vitamin D deficiency there, and you know, they're one of the fastest growing rates of IBD currently.
Interesting.
Whoa, very interesting.
So I have a question. Is there a genetic component to IBD?
I mean, I that is one potential risk factor, but it's not as big as you would think. I think it's more some of the you know, more of the microbiome influencing things, like NSAID use was another risk factor. You know, lots of alcohol and antibiotics in the diet can be a risk factor. Obviously, like standard American diet is definitely a risk factor. Yeah.
So this answered a lot of questions for me, because all this time I'm sitting here thinking autoimmune diseases run in my family, and particularly of the stomach variety. And I'm over here like, huh, okay, so I'm not doomed. Maybe we just drink a lot. Is that what it is? Like, so anyway.
There you go, fam. You got your shout out.
We got to stop drinking, everybody, or we're all going to end up with Crohn's. IBS.
I mean, IBD.
So that's, you just made me feel a lot better about my stomach's future. Thank you, Ashley.
Let's talk about what are, and we kind of touched on this, so fiber being one of those sort of inaccurate assumptions or myths about IBD is that you should avoid it. And I think, like, let's be honest, it does have a logical backstory to it. Fiber does not digest. It could cause irritation to the gut lining. Maybe for some people that's still the case, but that circles right back to your point that there's a difference between irritation and inflammation. Difference between irritation and inflammation. That's my biggest takeaway. I just, the way that you frame that, it makes a lot of sense, and it kind of gives this okayness to the idea of that something is to the idea that people are typically very uncomfortable with. So are there other things that kind of fall into that category that we can help share with people so that if they, maybe that's what they're operating with right now, that could be a very small switch that could really open the doors for them? Are there other kind of myths like this?
I would say nutrient deficiencies are another area that I think are underestimated, especially with IBD. So something about vitamin D in particular, people with IBD are more at risk to be low. People in flares, they're more likely to have severe flares with low vitamin D. So severity and length of time tends to be longer. The other thing that I think is really interesting is there, you know, because vitamin D regulates inflammation, what we've seen is that, you know, when it basically gets low because you have IBD, but then you have to replete it in order to really truly recover well or easier. So what we see with vitamin D is when you replete it, it can lower markers like fecal calprotectin, which measure inflammation in the colon, in some studies up to half.
Whoa, so that half? Was significant.
Yeah, there are some studies that show that it can decrease it up to a half. So so it can make a big difference. And that's just one nutrient of many. You know, with any sort of chronic inflammation, you're lowering a lot of different nutrients. And then with medications, certain medications will lower, especially prednisone.
Right.
Really notable for that.
Which they often prescribe for IBD at times, correct? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's a love-hate relationship with prednisone. But so those drugs also lower nutrients. And I think we don't give that area enough attention in terms of making sure that we're covering the ground and making sure that our bodies have what it needs to get to remission, because we focus a lot in IBD on utilizing drugs, but I feel like we don't focus enough on utilizing nutrition and nutrient deficiencies to get to that point too, because that's the other component that can really help amplify what your drugs are doing.
Symbioticness of it. Yeah, that's right. Interesting. Inflammation takes it out of you. Yeah. A lot, you know, and when it's chronic, which again is the defining feature here of IBD, yeah, it's again, we're adding to the list of things that you kind of, if you're seeking out your best possibility of getting into one of those four types of remission, right? Mm-hmm. Doing it in a shorter period of time and experiencing a flare that might be less intense. These are the things that you want to be looking at. Did I sum that up properly?
Yeah, I think that was good. And I'd say to add to that, I think one of the other big misconceptions is kind of that you have to choose between medication and nutrition. And what I hear all the time.
Pop that bubble, Ashley, pop it. I'm here for it. I know where you're going. Let's hear it.
Yeah. So what I hear all the time is people will say, well, you know, should I try this med first and see how it goes? How will I know which is working? And the truth is it's not, if what they're asking is they're asking, what's the one thing I can do that's going to cure it or make it better for good? I only want to do that one thing and nothing else. But the truth is that, you know, with IBD, it's typically a multifaceted approach. It's not just one thing. It's a combination of things. But two, you don't have to choose. You can, you know, most of the research studies that look at using nutrition, most of the participants are on medications already. So we know that nutrition can help amplify what your meds are doing. And I also think even with supplementation, there's a lot of different supplementation options for people that want to explore using a combination of both to amplify what their meds are doing. And a lot of those are studied with, you know, the common medications like mesalamine. I do think that's sort of a different take on nutrition for IBD. I think a lot of dietitians are a little hesitant to use supplementation with the IBD community, but I'm not one of those people. I think there's a lot of, if we have the tools, why don't we use them? You know, like why not? You know, especially for a community that really needs it.
It also kind of sounds like there is a point where a person, or maybe many points, where a person would need to get that leg up with the amount of nutrients. Because if you're saying, of course, that chronic inflammation can and medications and the things that are happening for somebody with IBD are constantly pulling from the body's nutrient resources, and then on top of that, they're not digesting and absorbing the foods well to really absorb the nutrients, that the bucket is pretty low. So it seems like there's probably a need to actually replenish and supplement to get them that leg up that they need. Is that right?
Yeah. And I also kind of understand the fear around it of, I know there are people that over supplement and that, you know, or maybe on dangerous things. And I'm not talking about self-prescribing or using something that's unnecessary. I'm talking about using something that is studied for IBD. Why not have another tool? I mean, this using that knowledge has been extremely beneficial to me personally and all of the clients that we see. You know, it's been the difference between, you know, being able to stay on the kind of lesser drugs and not having to advance, you know, because you're using another tool to get there and to keep you stable.
Yeah.
And you know, so I think there's a lot of room for using that and a lot of room for growth in IBD nutrition, you know, for kind of expanding to using more.
I'm going to invite you to join me on this tangent. We're going there. And I know this, Ashley, because you and I have had conversations about supplements. And I know that you know a lot, maybe an uncomfortable amount now because you can't unknow it, about the way that supplements vary. I'm trying to keep this vague. The way that supplements vary in their quality, in the testing that is performed on them to determine whether or not you're actually getting what the label suggests, in terms of whether or not the form in which it's being delivered is actually absorbed by the body or not. Just briefly, okay? Mm-hmm. So I would love to hear what you have to offer in terms of advice when it comes to supplements, because we just made a very solid case. Why not have those extra tools with things that are well-researched and the data supports is very helpful for IBD. So what are, and you could take this in whichever direction you feel called to take, but maybe what are some things that people might consider in terms of supplements for IBD? If there is a concern about quality, what might they think about? And you have your own line of supplements that you've designed, I can only imagine, from your personal experience and the work that you do with your clients. So if you want to kind of touch on any or all of those pieces and just give people a little snippet of the most useful pieces in case they want to explore this for themselves. Maybe they're just trying to play around or are curious and want to just dip a toe. What's a good starting point with some of that?
Yeah, I think a good starting point, if you're able to work with a dietitian that can customize a plan, that's the ideal point. Mm-hmm. You're not, looking for well-absorbed, third-party tested nutrients, which is hard to say what that would look like, but there are good brands, not just our brand, but I think Designs for Health is great. Mm-hmm. Metagenics has some good products. There's stuff over the counter like that. We actually just launched a powdered multi for people that are post surgery or have J pouch, or people who just don't want to do capsules.
That would be me. Amazing. I'll take it. Yeah. Give me all the powder multivitamins.
Yes. I'm with you. Uh-huh.
Can't swallow. Pills.
You went there. You had to. I did.
I had to throw it in there.
I love it. Thank you. Okay. Let's
Happy Friday, everybody. We're recording on a Friday.
Good. Okay. Yes. Keep going. A powdered multi.
Yeah. I would say if there was one thing that I think makes the biggest difference for people, it's we have a product called Gut Love, and it has sun fiber in it. And sun fiber helps a lot with urgency and diarrhea and even constipation. So it's not a laxative. It's not a it's a prebiotic fiber. So it helps to kind of fuel gut bacteria and can help to reduce urgency significantly. So I would say that's probably the one that if nothing else, that would be the one that I would suggest people start with.
I have used your Gut Love product for some of my clients and they have loved it.
Oh, that's awesome.
So thank you. Yeah. And I think the way that you describe it as it just being another tool is super important, because what we are not saying here, okay, this is key. What we are not saying is that, hey, take this supplement. It's all of a sudden going to be the magic wand to your problem and you're going to be totally fine. I think the consistent thing that you've been saying here, Ashley, is that it's a multifaceted approach. Everybody is super unique. You each have your own specific layer of variables that need to be addressed in different ways. And not to mention, that's going to change week to week, month to month, year to year, depending on what's going on. What's your environment look like? What's your stress look like? What's going on in your family? Did you move? What is the holidays, right? All of these things I can only assume. I mean, what's been your personal experience, right?
Yeah. I think whether or not you're in a flare, that's going to change, dosing and also where your disease is located. In our practice, we kind of narrow it down to three things. We want to see antioxidant support there. We want to see a prebiotic and we want to see anti-inflammatory support. So anti-inflammatory support, meaning like, Mariva curcumin or Boswellia or some of those types of herbals that have been studied alongside mesalamine to help bring down inflammation. So we want to see stuff like that. We want to see lots of antioxidants in the diet and then a prebiotic to kind of help restore gut flora a bit.
Do you have favorite, and I know not to point out specific foods, because what you've been saying is that it's the overall food pattern, but can you briefly just list some foods that are really high in antioxidants that people can incorporate into their diet? Again, not like, don't just eat blueberries, but like include more blueberries, or, you know, maybe it's not blueberries, question. Whatever you, yeah. whatever you would yeah. recommend.
I would say berries. Berries are one, leafy greens. Smoothies are a great way to not have some of that irritation component, because what you're doing is you're blending, and blending actually makes it more tolerable for people. So like doing things like smoothies, squashes, fish, nut butters, that sort of thing.
Mm. Okay, love that. Mm-hmm.
Do you have an opinion about gluten for IBD?
Ooh, good question. It's a hot topic.
I'm kind of middle of the road with it, but I used to be all for no gluten whatsoever. I've kind of swung back and forth with how I feel. I think the newer research that I've read on it shows that, you know, it really could be a component that we might want to consider for IBD. And I would say most of the people that we see end up already gluten-free, having explored that themselves. Mm. So, I do think there's some early research that, you know, points to we might want to do at least a gluten-free trial period, or just consider adding more gluten-free grains. That's the other, like, middle-of-the-road option, is maybe you don't go fully gluten-free, but maybe, you know, maybe you just add more of the gluten-free grains. And it's easy to do that these days. I'll also say, too, with microscopic colitis, there's a very high rate of celiac disease. So it is common there with microscopic colitis. It's also common. I see it a lot with Crohn's too.
And I just want to specify, because I feel like when you say gluten-free grains, some people may not know exactly what that means. What I hear is things like brown rice, sorghum, maybe some starchy vegetables, even though they're not grains, but like the gluten-free carbs is what I hear. But I just want to clarify that I don't think you're talking about like gluten-free bagels and gluten-free breads. Maybe, like, I'm not saying you can't have those things, but just, I think your emphasis was probably on different types of naturally gluten-free things. Is that right?
Yeah. Naturally gluten-free grains. Now, I'll also say, even though I try to be middle of the road about it, I am gluten-free. I can't do it. I've tried. Mm-hmm. I usually get sick every time, and even though I tested negative for celiac, I just don't do well with it. So, and it's an easy modification that doesn't affect my life all that much. So, and all of my family is the same. So don't know why that is. But.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think there's a lot of research that shows that even if people do not feel the inflammation from gluten, that it's one of those things that the way that it happens to be grown in our part of the world, it can be very inflammatory. And when we're dealing with a chronically inflamed disease, I think that's why I asked it. It does tend to be one of those things that people think about first, especially today. It's like a thing to be gluten-free, even if you don't have a problem with it. Mm-hmm. So I do. I just wanted to bring some attention to that. We've talked a lot about a flare. Will you just really briefly clarify, what does that mean? What is that?
So a flare-up would typically be where you're having inflammation. That can vary a lot in terms of severity. It could last a couple days. It could last years. We had one person that was in a flare for 12 years.
What?
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh. That person deserves an award.
Oof. Yeah, you can be in a flare for a long time. A flare, is ongoing inflammation, essentially. But for some people, it can look like, you know, I've had a flare where I had very few symptoms and didn't even know I was in a flare.
That was going to be my question. Can you sometimes be in a flare and not feel it or know it? You know, going back to your point about inflammation versus irritation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have been in a flare and not known it, and it typically will show up as fatigue. If you know, when you're not very symptomatic, it might show up with fatigue. I've also had flares where they're very severe, going, you know, 30 times a day, having tons of urgency, bleeding, bleeding at a dangerous level to where, you know, you have to go to the hospital. I've had fevers, nausea, vomiting. So I've had that kind of flare. And then, you know, it seems like the further I've gone into my IBD, the less they've been like that, thankfully. They've typically been shorter and a little more controlled because I take action sooner, for one.
Right.
You know, I don't let it go very long.
Wait, can I ask you, Ashley? You mentioned I take action sooner. What does that look like? Now, and you can speak to what it is that you actually do, or more generally some ideas, because I think that's probably the real bread and butter of what our conversation is here. When people who already know that they have IBD, they know what a flare feels like. They haven't explored nutrition or supplements maybe. Are there things that you can sort of say, hey, grasp for these things and see what it feels like for you? What might some of that look like?
Yeah. One, I think it means leaning on your healthcare team. I mean, personally, I think every healthcare team should have an IBD specialized dietitian. I think it means reaching out to that person, reaching out to your GI. It's important to lean on people when you're in a vulnerable state like that, because, you know, for me, when I'm about to go into flare, I feel it. Like, I call it flare brain. Like, it starts mentally for me. Like, it starts with
wow,
like a sense of pending doom, like anxiety, sadness. I will typically cry because I can feel it. I just know that it's coming on. Yeah, so it's important. I know I'm not thinking in the same way when I'm in that state. So I do try to really lean on providers that I trust to help me navigate that, because I'm not the best person to give myself healthcare in that moment. Even though I know a lot about what I can do, I do tend to lean on other people in that place. So it might mean adjusting medication. It might mean adjusting my own nutrition protocol. It might mean leaning on someone to look at my nutrition protocol instead of myself, you know? Yeah. So that's the starting
point. Let me ask you, what about, because I know there are going to be people hearing this who are thinking, I hate my doctor. I don't have a healthcare team. You know, because, I mean, have you been in that position
before?
And what do you tell those people? It's very, like you said, I love the word vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And to not have a safe team of people who you trust, have your best interests and know you on hand to be able to access in these moments. Wow. I don't know. What are your thoughts? What do you have to say? What soothing advice might you have to offer?
Yeah, I mean, okay, the sad truth is that I've had IBD for like 12 years now. 11 of those years, I haven't liked my doctor. only recently. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Only recently have I found a doctor that, one, I just feel totally comfortable with. She asked me about nutrition in the first conversation. She was totally on board. Yeah, she was totally on board with my supplementation regimen and knew all of the research. And that's like more than you can ask for, right?
Yeah.
So it only took me 11 years to find one.
All right, let's find the silver lining. You guys who are feeling this way, you are not alone. Mm-hmm. And there's hope. Right? Like you have to search around a little bit and maybe that support isn't your healthcare team if you don't have that. Who are your friends and your family and the people who surround you in your day-to-day life that you can lean on to have some sort of support? Because I think the interesting thing for me that you mentioned is that mentally you're not in a good space to make decisions for your own health. I mean, anybody can relate to that. Any human being who has ever felt extreme discomfort from anything can relate to that idea that, you know, I'm not top of my game right now. I can't really be trusted you should do critical thinking about my health, right?
Yeah, I will also add, for people that are looking for a new GI, I'd also say, you know, looking for someone who's a specialist. So not all GIs are specialists. I didn't know this until well into my diagnosis, but not all are specialized in IBD. And it can make a big difference in terms of the type of care you're getting. So, you know, sometimes looking online, asking questions, interviewing when you are feeling good, you know, when you're feeling up for doing some of that, so that your future self can thank you for, you know, when you do get to clear.
Amazing advice. That's amazing advice. Yeah. And we'll link to your supplements for people who might be curious in the show notes, everybody. So you'll have that to access if you're curious. And of course, reminding you all that the ideal scenario is that you're working with somebody who deeply knows you, who you trust, who can make specialized, personalized recommendations based on testing and blood work and stool samples and blah, 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 all the things. That isn't the reality for everybody, and we know that. So to give you a little bit of a starting point, I think would be helpful, right?
Yeah, I also think that my takeaway from this too is that for people either working with a healthcare team that they trust or not, a lot of those prevention strategies that you mentioned are very doable. So maybe that's the area where somebody who doesn't fully feel like they can lean on their healthcare provider just yet puts their focus is more in the prevention, maybe looking into, you know, those antioxidants, the fiber, the diet patterns that you mentioned. I think you had said, I forgot what the statistic was, but it seems to help keep people out of remission for longer in certain cases, or maybe make them shorter, right? So I think that would be a good
into
option
remission
too.
Yes.
Oh yes, sorry. Oh my God, what am I thinking? Yeah, I had it backwards.
I heard you too. I was gonna
yes, in
right,
remission.
Meg. Those are super good points. Right. Because it seems like, hey, this is no joke. This sort of nutrition and or supplemental approach is not a thing that's like those crunchy people do. Right. I think sometimes, let's just clear that up. Sometimes that can be seen as super alternative or like really hippy dippy. It's like that's the science isn't showing that. The science, in fact, exists. And it is. And I always like to say this to people. What goes through your GI system? You have an inflamed gastrointestinal system. What goes through that? Your food. Why would you not look at that? Why would you not emphasize it, in fact? So I think I want to make that point really clear. This is not a thing that's for those people. It's for you. The science is there now. It might not be talked about quite accurately yet, but it's definitely real. And it should be very encouraging to you. So I hope it's not feeling overwhelming. Or rather, I should say, if this is feeling overwhelming, we get it. Mm-hmm. But let it kind of sit and, pun intended, digest it a little bit. Because mm-hmm. I think that, to your point, Meg, there's a lot of action, right? That's mm-hmm. what we're all about here. What can you take from this and actually put into your real world and your life? I mean, you know, we just gave you a whole list of things that have high antioxidants that we know mm-hmm. are super helpful here. We know about fiber. We've mentioned several different supplements if you wanted to play around with your hand at that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those are the things that I want people to take away.
Yes, the low-hanging fruit, as you often call it, Kylie, which is so accurate. Yes. And also, I haven't said this in the in our previous episodes, but it just occurred to me that it would be helpful if I did. So if any of our episodes do start to feel kind of overwhelming, we talk about a lot here to our listeners, I break it down for you in the show notes. So you have your own cheat sheet in the show notes. And it's funny that we didn't say that
haven't
until
mentioned
now,
that.
But yeah, whoops.
This is actually a very good one to know that about. I'm glad you said that, because there's going to be a lot of things you're going to want just a quick reference about. And Ashley's information and the links to her supplements and her websites. And I have seen this, you guys. She's got a ton of information on our website, an amazing blog, lots and lots of resources. So even post this conversation, you aren't going to be left hanging it to dry.
Yeah, we do try to add a lot of free stuff for people, and because not everyone, this, you know, we know that not everyone can afford to get the type of healthcare they deserve. So our blogs are a good place to go, and we're also doing, we're launching a IBD nutrition library soon, which will be a really low cost way to get answers quick.
Is that going to be available on your website, Ashley, the Crohn's and Colitis Dietitians.com?
Yes, yeah.
Also, I'm going to do a little plug for you real quick. For those of you who are searching for somebody to add to your healthcare team, it's not just Ashley. There are four of you at your practice, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And all of you have IBD. I know from conversations with you that that was something that was a non-negotiable as you are hiring new dietitians to join your team. And so if you, in terms of having the people know what you feel and how your experience feels, I mean, this is it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it just so happened that the people that were the best fit for the role, that they, you know, I think a lot of it boils down to like they, when you understand deeply what they're going through, it just makes you, you just want to help. You want to help people that have that because you know how hard it can be.
Right. Yeah. Right, right. So I think there's something really, really magical about feeling, the feeling of being understood. It can really open the door to allow you to be vulnerable and therefore receive a different level of support and guidance and care. So I think that's amazing. And again, yeah, we'll put all of that information in the show notes so you guys can have super easy access to it. Ashley,
thank you so much.
Is there anything else that you want to share before we very gratefully say goodbye?
Yeah, I guess to your point about being overwhelmed, I know that's often the case for people that have IBD. There's a lot that you're managing on your own, typically. I would say if there's one takeaway that you could have from our talk today, it's to understand that there's a difference between irritation and inflammation, and to understand that there's a realistic fear that we have around food, and just try to be a little more open and curious about trying new things and trying to expand your diet a little bit. So even if you're doing it on your own, just be patient with yourself and trying food different ways can make a big difference.
I love that.
Whoa. Yeah. That was that summed everything up in like the most concise and satisfying manner.
Yeah.
Where can people find you?
Yeah. So I'm on Instagram, Crohn's_and_colitis_dietitian. And you can also go to Crohn's and Colitis Dietitians.com.
Perfect.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much, Ashley. This was so great and helpful.
So it's good to chat with you.
I always learn so much. I mean, I'm in this space of gut health and there's so much to know. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to be in your company, Ashley. Thank you. Thank you for taking your time and for being here. We appreciate you tremendously. So thank you.
Yes.
And thank you. We will see all of you next week.
Yeah. All right. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to Curious Women. If you love our show, you can support us by leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And if you know someone else who would really love our show, please share it with them too.